Okay, so yesterday you did not appreciate Vovichka at all, and so enough with him. Today I would like to introduce Vovichka's little sister Masha, okay, who is kind of a different character, in the same family, who's not, well, she's just a different character who you may take as being introduced by the following joke. So Vovichka says, "Masha, Masha, tonight we're going to do something that's not allowed. Tonight we're going to do something nobody's allowed to do. You can't do it and get away with it." Masha, who greatly admires her older brother but doesn't always understand him, says, "What, Vovichka? Divide by zero." Anyway. That's Masha. Okay, before moving on to discuss sort of thermodynamics in an expanding space-time, some basic points about that and just about, let's say, particle physics more generally. What are the main effects of the expansion of space-time? Let's just say a few more words about the dynamics of the Friedmann-Robertson-Walker universe. So, we have the Friedmann equation, which looks like so. And then we had the continuity equation, and we said an important special case, the universe that you live in, one of the reasons this is an important special case is that you can analytically solve everything and see nicely and analytically how things behave. But another reason this is important is that the universe that you live in definitely did spend long periods of time like this, and then hypothetically also spent other important periods of times like this. Like this is in the situation where the equation of state for P in terms of rho, P as a function of rho, is just a linear proportionality with some constant of proportionality W. Okay, so P is just proportional to rho, some fraction W of rho. So then we said last time you can just analytically solve this equation, and the solution is simply that rho dilutes as a power of A. So as the universe expands, rho dilutes as a W-dependent power of A. So the bigger W is, the faster rho dilutes as A expands. Okay. So now let's plug this into this equation, and then before solving this equation, it's useful to just notice that you can extract the qualitative behavior. Yeah, without solving it. So, okay, so just to take an example of what I mean, let's take the case where a closed universe, K is equal to plus one. So the spatial sections of the universe are closed three spheres. Then, so the left-hand side of this equation is manifestly positive. So the right-hand side had better be positive as well. But when k is equal to plus one, it contains two terms: one that is negative, and so the other one that, in order to ensure that the left-hand side is equal to be positive, this one had better be positive as well. And it doesn't just have to be positive, it has to be sufficiently positive that it overcompensates for this negative piece. So let's look at two, there's sort of two qualitatively different cases here, depending on how big W is. If W is bigger than minus 1/3. So in other words, if the pressure is greater than minus 1/3 the energy density, then where the energy density, again, in this case, had better be positive, rho naught had better be positive in order to ensure that this side is positive to be consistent with this side being manifestly positive. So if W is greater than minus 1/3, that says that this term scales, it decays faster than a to the minus 2. So in other words, this term dominates for sufficiently small a. This term would dominate for sufficiently large a, but we can't let that happen because this term is negative. Okay, so in other words, when W is is greater than minus 1/3, and this term dominates for sufficiently small a, this equation is a constraint on a. It's saying a has to be smaller than some value. If a gets too large, then this term gets smaller than this term, the whole right-hand side would become negative. That wouldn't make sense. Okay, so in other words, just from that analysis, you can see, so if the universe starts out with a very small and expanding, well, it has to reach some maximum size. And if you think about it a little bit more, you find I guess you could imagine that maybe it would just sit at that maximum size. But differentiating this equation with respect to time, you find that, in fact, at this moment, when a dot goes to 0, a double dot does not go to 0. It's negative in this case. So what it in fact does is it comes back down to 0 size. So in a spatially closed universe where the matter is something like non-relativistic dust or relativistic photons or anything with W greater than minus 1/3, that's what the universe does. It expands from a big bang where A equals 0, and a finite time later it contracts to a big crunch where A is 0 again. On the other hand, if W was less than minus 1/3 here, okay, then every step of the story would be reversed. In order for this equation to be satisfied and for this side to be positive, consistent with this side's positivity, A has to be sufficiently large, and you find that instead, the universe starts from an infinite value of A, contracts, bounces at some finite value, and re-expands to an infinite value again. Okay, so this is just to give you a sense of the sort of how you can go through and qualitatively classify the different sorts of solutions that the universe can undergo when it has this, at least when it has this sort of simple matter content. But anyway, rather than doing all of those cases, I just wanted to skip to it's one thing that really is worth knowing is that the general solution for A as a function of time, not just the qualitative solution, is available explicitly analytically. Let's see. Let me stop erasing what I read on the board. So let me just quickly sketch how that goes. So 8 pi g over 3 rho, and then as we did over here, I'll substitute in rho is equal to rho naught a over a naught to the minus 3, 1 plus w. And then let me, okay, so h is equal to a dot over a squared. I mean, so h squared is equal to a dot over a squared. But remember, a dot is equal to dA dt, but dt is equal to a d eta. So this is also equal to 1 over a dA d eta. Or in other words, a prime over a. Remember, a prime is conventionally used in cosmology to mean a conformal time derivative, a derivative with respect to eta. Okay, so now, so we have this expression is equal to this expression. Now it's just a simple matter of algebra, which I won't do on the board, to check that if I make the substitution Let's see. So if I switch from this scale factor A to this new, I define a new kind of scale factor A twiddle, where this A is just a constant. It's a portion, capital A is a proportionality constant. Okay, so I make that substitution, and it's easy to check that this equation becomes a much nicer looking equation. Okay, and so this guy, for any particular value of k, you'll discover that this is just the equation for a sine or a sinh anyway, to make a long story short, by inspection, the general solution, this equation is easy enough that you can just solve it explicitly without any further simplification. And the solution is, when you convert back from a twiddle, so you solve for a twiddle, and a twiddle is like, for example, if k is plus 1, the solution for a twiddle here is sine, is a twiddle would be a twiddle would be sine of eta over a constant, which is one over this. Okay, let me say this a different way. Rather than being confusing, the general solution, which let me stick to the policy that let's check the algebra offline, off the board. But the general solution is see, this is one of these formulas that's nice enough and general enough and useful enough that I just without it's one of these formulas that's useful enough that you end up remembering it without, even though you shouldn't really remember it. But our alpha is a constant just defined in terms of w for convenience, 2 over 1 plus 3w. Eta is the conformal time. This function s sub k of x is the same function we met before when we were writing the FRW metric in terms of chi coordinates, remember? It's this guy that's sine of x or sinh of x or x, depending on whether k is equal to plus 1, minus 1, or 0. Yeah, so you can just check. So here, this is the general solution of the Friedmann equations for an arbitrary value of k and an arbitrary value of w. This is it. These are all the possibilities, and you can just check what the behavior looks like for various possible values. And you know, when k is equal to 0 or minus 1, you see that basically eta is semi-infinite, either runs from minus infinity to 0 or 0 to plus infinity, and the universe either expands or contracts from 0 size to infinite size or vice versa. And then in the case where k equals plus 1, eta runs over a finite range and has one of these two behaviors that I drew. Okay? And so then the one final thing about dynamics before we move on to thermodynamics is just a brief introduction to the so-called flatness problem. So last time we met, last time, you know, I drew a diagram like this, which was the pictorial introduction to the so-called horizon problem. That in the standard picture of the universe, let's set aside for a moment the fact that there is some observed dark energy today, that the universe appears to have some that very recently in the universe's history, something called dark energy began to become important. Okay, that turns out to be more or less, or at least if it's relevant to these problems, it's very highly non-obvious. So setting that aside, the standard picture of cosmology was that the energy density in the universe has two components. So some matter density, some non-relativistic matter, which dilutes like non-relativistic matter does as a to the minus 3, and some relativistic matter, some radiation, rho radiation, times which scales, which dilutes more quickly as a to the minus 4. Remember, these are we discussed this last time. These are two cases of the formula that you get by solving the continuity equation. And I gave a simple physical argument why non-relativistic matter scales as if W is equal to 0, which is this, which gives this a to the minus 3 behavior, and relativistic matter, radiation, scales like W equals 1/3, which gives this a to the minus 4 behavior when you plug it in here. So I just sketched the idea last time that if you draw what such a universe looks like on a conformal diagram, on a diagram that has chi on this axis and eta on this axis, you see there's something of a puzzle, which is if you point your microwave telescope out in two opposite directions on the sky and look along two different rays on your light cone, the moment at which the CMB was released is rather close to the Big Bang in this model, in these chi eta coordinates. And so it looks like the point on the CMB that released these photons to you was completely out of causal contact. Its past light cone was non-overlapping with the one on the opposite side of the sky. And so how did they know to be in virtually the same state at the same temperature and in thermal equilibrium at the same temperature? And we said there were various possible suggestions about how to sort of strategies for how to give an answer to that puzzle. Okay, so and this is also closely related to two other, you know, this is clearly very closely related to two other puzzles you will hear about, sometimes called the isotropy puzzle. You know, we've been taking it for granted that the universe is at zeroth order. I mean, it's an observational fact that at zeroth order, the universe is described by a Friedman-Robertson-Walker metric. And one consequence of that is if you look out in any direction on the sky, the universe looks essentially the same in a statistical standpoint. So the CMB, the cosmic microwave background, looks the same in any direction on the sky. The number of galaxies is the same over here as over here. They have the same properties over here as over here, and so forth. So that's the isotropy puzzle. And again, the question is, why is that true? If you look far enough out in this direction and far enough out in this direction, that the light that you're receiving was emitted by two regions that, according to a diagram like this, were out of causal contact with one another. And then, so that's the so-called isotropy problem or puzzle. And then there's a homogeneity puzzle, which these are probably just all statements of the same thing, just slightly different twists on the same thing. How did the universe at some early moment know to be the same everywhere when at that early moment widely separated regions appear to have not had time to exchange light signals, let alone come into thermal equilibrium since the Big Bang? Okay, but so now I want to just sketch a different puzzle, the so-called flatness puzzle. So that amounts to the statement that in various ways, you can count up how much energy density there is in the universe today. And then you can also measure what H is today and compare them. And what you do, what you get when you find that is, what you get when you do that is that the energy density today matches the critical density that I introduced last time, the total energy density today, to very good accuracy. Such good accuracy, so in other words, if the universe were perfectly flat, if k was equal to 0, then we would have this equation. We would have a definite relation between the energy density today and the rate at which the universe was expanding today. And in fact, all observations currently indicate that relation holds to within the observational accuracy. So we've measured that this relation is true to roughly, so that rho today is roughly this critical density, plus or minus roughly 1%, which is the best that we can do at the moment. So we have no evidence that this term contributes at all on this side. But okay, so why is that a puzzle? Well, one solution to that is to say, okay, maybe k is actually strictly zero. Then no problem. Then what we're observing just matches observations. But if k is not zero, k equals zero is the borderline critical case between an open universe of arbitrary curvature. You know, k equals zero sounds like a finely tuned case. I could have a sphere of arbitrary positive radius of curvature or arbitrary negative radius of curvature. So each of those, there's a sort of infinite family of possible curvatures that I could have. Or the flat plane, a radius of curvature strictly equal to infinity. So choosing k equals zero is like choosing that case. But if the radius of curvature is at all finite, so in other words, k really is plus or minus one here, then the problem is that in a universe like this, the two contributions to rho here, I write this expression as a function of time, the two contributions of rho scaled like a to the minus 4. There's a part that scales like a to the minus 4 and a part that scales like a to the minus 3. So in other words, they're dropping faster as the universe expands. They're dropping faster than this term, which only drops as a to the minus 2. So, but it's very late in the universe. The universe is at least 13 billion years old, which is stupendously long relative to any other scales in fundamental physics, you know, transitions in atoms and so forth. So why is it that even at this very late stage, or stated another way, the universe has expanded by an enormous number of powers of A? A has expanded by an enormous ratio. So why is it that this term has not yet caught up to this one? Not only not caught up, but it's still so small that we don't observe it. So anyway, you may or may not be somehow how struck you are by that puzzle is it may be kind of a matter of personal taste. It's not exactly with both of these things, how much you are puzzled by that puzzle or bothered by it may be a matter of personal taste. Nevertheless, it's worth mentioning that one of the reasons that people were originally very excited about inflation, the idea of tacking on a period of inflation in the early universe, is that it seems to ease both of these rather different looking puzzles at the same time. So again, the idea of inflation is you tack on a period of a double dot greater than zero in the early universe. So that amounts to saying that at some early time, the energy density here, stated another way, the idea of inflation is to tack on a period in the early universe where the energy density was not dominated by ordinary matter and radiation like it is today. It was dominated by some more strange component, some more exotic component, which scales less quickly than, which drops less quickly than a to the minus 2. So in fact, usually in most models of inflation, it stays roughly constant with time. And so the idea here is that if the basic puzzle is that the energy density in the universe is falling faster than so this is proportional to a to the minus 3 or a to the minus 4, depending on what epoch we look at, but it's falling faster than the curvature, which is only falling as a to the minus 2, you know, why hasn't this guy caught up yet? The answer of inflation is that, well, you put in an early epoch where this guy is falling faster than this guy, and you just let that epoch go on for such a long time that at the end of that period of inflation, this term is stupendously larger. The energy density term has become stupendously larger than this one, and only then, at the end of that period, do you take this energy density, whatever was quote unquote driving the period of inflation, and then you convert it into normal matter and radiation at the epoch of so-called quote unquote reheating at the end of inflation. So you know that's the idea. You give it you extend things back so that there was an earlier period where the matter density, where the dominant energy density in the universe was staying roughly constant or dropping more slowly than this. You let this drop by an enormous factor, and then at the end of that, at the period of so-called reheating, you take all that energy density and you allow it to decay into the matter and radiation of the Standard Model of Particle Physics. And you just give it a huge head start that way. You give it an initial condition where that energy density is so huge relative to the curvature contribution on the right-hand side here that even over the enormous subsequent decades of expansion of the universe, there hasn't been enough time to catch up. But it's this idea that adding a component like this with rho that scales less steeply than a to the minus 2, that it alleviates both the flatness problem, but then also drives a period with accelerated expansion, which for reasons that I explained last time also alleviates this problem by taking the bottom of this diagram and moving it down a long way or maybe even to minus infinity. That was one of the first things that intrigued people, was that it solved these two rather different puzzles in a common way. And then they wrote down more explicit models of what could be driving inflation, and those models made detailed quantitative predictions for the primordial fluctuations that you can see statistically and that you can observe, tiny fluctuations from point to point on the sky in the cosmic microwave background or in the galaxy distribution. And the confirmation of those by subsequent experiments in the late 90s and early 2000s is what has kind of suddenly made it by far the most popular model of the early universe. But that was sort of how it started. Yes. That what is precisely zero?
The curvature k is precisely zero.
Does it make any sense in a strictly homogeneous universe? You could have. I mean, so the maybe I should ask why. I think so, but why not?
Yeah, well,
a k precisely zero just would mean a universe that just is infinite but with zero curvature.
So is there some? Because the real universe is not homogeneous, right? So is there some analogy solution possible for an inhomogeneous universe which would correspond to the k equals zero for the homogeneous one?
Yeah. So that's a very good question. So that's right. So far we've been dealing with the zeroth order approximation to our universe, neglecting the fact that that things actually fluctuate from point to point in space at a given time. And in that case, we have this simple situation where either the whole thing closes up as a sphere, or the whole spatial section is a flat plane, or the whole spatial section is somehow an infinite hyperboloid. That's terribly drawn, but if you have an inhomogeneous universe, then yes, for example, if you have an inhomogeneous universe that on average is spatially flat, but there's a little bit more matter density over here, and a little bit less matter density over here, then an observer who can only observe, let's say, a region this big, will perceive the universe around him as being best fit by a spatially closed universe, and the observer who can only see who's the edge of what he can see extends only out into this underdense region will see what appears to be to him a slightly open universe. So that's right. Once the universe can be inhomogeneous, then that sort of thing is possible. And in fact, that is also, you know, it turns out that appears to be the sort of thing that inflation can predict. It can predict that although you happen to live in a patch of the universe that has been stretched in such a way as to make it look extremely close to flat at the epoch that you live in, that other observers at different spatial points or at different times will see their local region as resembling a Friedman-Robertson-Walker universe that could be open or closed. In fact, that's one of the things that people complain more and more modern cosmologists complain about with inflation is that what appears initially to be a nice resolution to a problem can, for various reasons, give a more ambiguous prediction than was originally hoped. But.
Well, that ties up with homogeneity problem.
Mm-hmm.
If I have a balloon and balloon of gas and then in vacuum I exploded, then it would be isotropian homogeneity, right? Or is it more homogeneous?
If you have a balloon and you explode it,
yeah,
like
then
the balloon,
the gas would distribute.
The balloon breaks, you mean, or
yeah.
You inflate the balloon?
No, I just
you let off an explosion. You let off an explosion.
Yeah.
If you set up the explosion so that it was originally homogeneously and isotropically expanding, then it would remain so. Yeah. I mean, in other words, only very special explosions look homogeneous and isotropic.
Well, but there is a frame which is, well.
So the way the actual universe goes is that it becomes less homogeneous and isotropic over time, if that's for what that's worth. So what we actually observe is that the cosmic microwave background was released to us at an early enough moment in cosmic history that the universe really was extremely homogeneous over the whole region that we could see. The fluctuations in density from one point to another were less than a part in 100,000. Whereas today, they've grown to be much bigger than that. So today you have to really squint so that your vision is so blurry that you can't see scales smaller than some 10 mega, 30 light years or something like that. I mean, 30 million light years. If you look on scales bigger than that, you can still see that the universe is homogeneous and isotropic. But if you try to, but on scales smaller than that, it's become very inhomogeneous. Let me march along. So that in brief is the idea of the flatness puzzle and why it was at least originally hoped, or at least in the naive picture, inflation gives a solution to it as well as the horizon problem. Let's now do thermodynamics in the remaining time. Okay, so. Let's say we have phase space, okay, parameterized by, so phase space, you know, the phase space of a particle has some coordinates, three spatial coordinates and three momentum coordinates. And now we want to talk about statistical mechanics or thermodynamics in expanding spacetime. And so the basic object is a probabilistic one, the distribution function, f of x pt. So the distribution function has the meaning, you know, the distribution function f sub I for species I, where species I might be, for example, the distribution I here might mean as many quantum numbers as I need to specify a species of particle. So electrons with spin with left-handed helicity, with spin pointed opposite to their momentum, for example. That's an example of a species of particle in the standard model. So for every such species, its distribution function just has the meaning that if I multiply it by d cubed x and d cubed p, a little infinitesimal six-dimensional volume in its six-dimensional phase space, this is the expected number of particles in that little volume, particles of that species in that volume at time t. Okay, so if I want to know the number density of these particles, in other words, the number of the ith species as a function of space at time t, I just have to integrate the distribution function over all possible momenta. And on the other hand, if I want to know the energy density of the ith species at a given point in space and a given point in time, I have to, you know, integrate over all possible momenta, not just the number of particles, but the energy contained in every little cell of d cubed p. In other words, I include a factor of the energy of the ith species when it has momentum p. So for example, that the energy of the electron would be square root of momentum squared, square root of its momentum squared, times its mass of the electron squared. Or I should say plus the mass of the electron squared. Okay, and so then a key result from statistical mechanics that I'm just going to quote here, but that undoubtedly you've seen derived. Or if you haven't seen it derived, actually, I shouldn't say undoubtedly. If you haven't seen it derived, come talk to me after class. But I think most of you will have seen this derived in a statistical mechanics class. So the result is, if you take a volume in phase space whose size is h cubed, Planck's constant cubed, so in other words, 2 pi h bar cubed, that has the right units. That has units of, you know, length cubed times momentum cubed. So if you take a little volume of that size, the expected number of particles of the ith species in that volume is given by the so-called Bose-Einstein or Fermi-Dirac distribution function, which is this famous function. Okay, so 1 over the exponential of e minus mu sub I. Here mu sub I is the so-called chemical potential associated with the ith species, divided by K Boltzmann, which henceforth I will set to 1. So this is the last time you'll ever see K Boltzmann. But the Boltzmann's constant times the temperature of the ith species, where I'm just leaving in the temp. Usually you just think of the whole system as being at a common temperature, but here I'm just leaving leaving this because actually it happens sometimes in cosmology that you can have two different species or two different sets of species, and one set are all in equilibrium with one another at some temperature, and the other set are all in equilibrium with themselves at a different temperature. Okay, so in other words, n sub I of x and t for a species in equilibrium. What am I trying to say? I'm trying to say that why am I making this so confusing? Forget that last step. So the distribution function in thermal equilibrium, the Bose-Einstein distribution function, is this expression with the minus sign in the denominator. And so in other words, if I is a bosonic species, or if I is a fermionic species, then I take the plus sign. That's the so-called Fermi-Dirac distribution function. Yeah, I left out the t here because normally a system in thermal equilibrium does not evolve in time, and so what I was about to say was that okay, so that would be in normal statistical mechanics, that would be the Bose-Einstein or Fermi-Dirac distribution function, but now, well, as the universe expands, you know, it's not strictly in equilibrium; it's expanding. I mean, it is changing. It's changing with time. That's sort of the basic assumption about the space-time, and so we want to know what is the effect on this. But first, so to figure that out, I write these expressions in the notes. Oh, the notes for this lecture should be on the wiki, by the way. I should have said, and then it's an exercise on the homework to check them. So if we take this distribution function, plug it into these two expressions for n sub I and rho sub I, so this is an integral over d cubed p, but really the integrand only depends on the magnitude of p. It only depends on e, which only depends on the magnitude of p. So we can change integration variables. This is only an integral. The integrand only depends on one variable, the radial direction in momentum space, the magnitude of p. And then we can use this expression to switch from the magnitude of the momentum to the energy as the integration variable. And when you do that, you get at this point, you might be desperately in need of another joke, but I should probably. You may just while I'm writing here, you may just want to remember a previous joke, like one of the few that you actually laughed at, and just like chuckle at it again in memory. Just like a time-conserving strategy. Okay, So you get these expressions for the number density, the number per unit physical volume, and the energy density, the energy per unit physical volume, for a system in thermal equilibrium. And then for most cases, the key point is you don't need these full expressions. There are two limits of these expressions that are much simpler and that are very important, that correspond to situations that commonly arise in cosmology and can be derived from here, that it is worth knowing. So one of those cases is when the particles are relativistic. In other words, the temperature is much greater than their mass, and non-degenerate. So the temperature is also much greater than their chemical potential. So remember what it means for a particle to be degenerate. If you have an ideal gas of Bose particles in quantum stat mech, as the temperature gets sufficiently low, you can have this phenomenon of Bose-Einstein condensation arise. And that when Bose-Einstein condensation becomes significant, when the temperature is that low, you say that the Bose gas is degenerate, or with fermions, the temperature can get so low that all of the fermions want to clump into a sphere with a well-defined Fermi surface in momentum space, and they want to just be packed in there as tightly as they can, with only one particle per quantum state as allowed by for fermions. Okay, so. In this case, where the temperature is big relative to both the mass and the chemical potential, then the only dimensionful quantity in town is T. And so by dimensional analysis, we can figure out what these things have to end up looking like. So this is number per unit volume. And in units where h bar is equal to c is equal to 1, in sort of high energy physics units or atomic physics units, length is proportional to 1 over energy or 1 over mass. And then in units where k Boltzmann is equal to 1, energy and temperature have the same units. So this is number per unit volume. So it's proportional to length to the minus 3, or in other words, energy to the 3. So this has to go as temperature cubed on dimensional grounds. And then if you just do these integrals explicitly and exactly. If you set mu into m equal to 0 here and here, and here and here. You can do the integrals exactly and get the prefactor. So it's zeta of 3 over pi squared. This is the Riemann zeta function. And again, the energy density is energy per volume. So that's energy over length cubed, which is energy to the fourth. So it has to go as temperature to the fourth. And then the prefactor here is pi squared over 30. And then the one final point is that when you're going through the integrals, you'll find that depending on whether you have a minus 1 or plus 1 in the denominator, you'll get a slightly different answer. So this should all be multiplied by a factor of 1 for both if I is a bosonic species, or 3/4 if it's a fermionic species. And again, down here, a factor of 1 for bosons and a factor of 7/8 for fermions. Okay, so that's what happens in the relativistic limit. That's how the energy density and number density depend on temperature in the relative for species that are relativistic. And then the other thing we want is the non-relativistic limit. So in the non-relativistic limit, and again, both of these things are exercises that will be done that I won't do on the board, but they're straightforward exercises that you should do once in your life, and will do either in the tutorial or on the homework. So the number density. So now, in the non-relativistic case, you know, there's two. I should just do the whole. That'll be more entertaining if I do it all like this. You'll all pay more attention, or I could just lie down and sort of model for you. So now we have two masses that now we have multiple scales, multiple dimensionful quantities that we have to deal with, none of which can be neglected, and so we can expect that we'll have to deal with slightly more messy formulas, and we do. But they're not so bad. So the non-relativistic, this is one of the messiest formulas that you will have to deal with in the whole of the cosmology course. By messy, I don't mean longest. I just mean kind of grossest, least elegant. But nevertheless, it's important enough that here it is. That you should derive it once in your life. And okay, and then the energy density. Well, for a non-relativistic species, the energy density is just the energy of each particle is just, to a first approximation, its mass. And so you can expect that the energy density is just the mass times the number density. Okay, and indeed that's the case. Although you should check it. Okay, so what does this say? So now. Well, let's do one more thing before we decide what this says. Yeah. Say it again. But not at small temperatures.
No. Why not the same? Because we have just Boltzmann statistics at high temperature.
Well, I encourage you to work it out. There's only a small effect, but the overall effect at large temperatures is this factor of 7/8. Think about it this way, suppose you send mu and m to zero in this expression. Then you have two dimensionful quantities, the dummy variable E and T. So let's just switch variables to a dimensionless variable X, which is equal to E over T. Then we'll have some expression of the form integral from 0 to infinity dx times some universal function of this dimensionless variable. But this function will be it'll be some power of x in the numerator for these two different expressions, and then divided by e to the x plus or minus 1. So I mean, if the integral, I think maybe the thing, it is true that in the limit that the energy is big relative to t, so that x is very large here, when the integrand for x is very large, then the e to the x dominates over the plus or minus 1, and you can get rid of it. But to get the energy density or the number density, we're integrating from x equals 0 to infinity. So we're not just, so that's it. That's what I should have said originally. So the distribution function itself for sufficiently large energies, just the plus or minus 1 does become negligible. But to get the energy density or number density integrated over energy, you can't neglect it. Okay, so I just wanted to say something about. So let's see. One of the main results we want to extract is that when you have a relativistic gas of relativistic particles, radiation, and the universe expands, that the temperature decreases as 1 over A. Okay, that's maybe the main result to take away here. And we just want to see one. There's actually various different ways to derive this, but Well, to my mind, this is one of the simpler ones. So the first law of thermodynamics, I remind you, says that if you make a little change in a system, the change in its energy is T times dS, the change in its entropy, minus the pressure times the change in its volume. So now let's rewrite the energy as the, okay, we're going to use the fact that our system is, in cosmology, is homogeneous. So the energy is just the energy in some, and let's just focus on, to not have to sort of think about infinities, let's just focus on some finite co-moving volume that expands along with the universe, some box that expands along with the universe, so it has fixed co-moving coordinates, but it grows in physical size, just so that, so it's a finite volume, but all of the matter, at least on average, is co-moving with the expansion. So it's not, so there's no net flow of matter out of any of the walls or into any of the walls. So it's just a way of cutting off a finite chunk of the universe and studying its thermodynamics. So we'll write rho we'll write the energy as the energy density times the volume of that box. And we'll write the entropy as the entropy density times the volume of that box. And the pressure times the change in the volume of that box. Okay, and now in thermal equilibrium, intrinsic quantities like P, S, and rho only depend on the temperature. They don't depend on the volume of the system. So let's expand this out as d rho d temperature d temperature times the volume, and then a second term rho dv, and then the other side of the equation I'll expand down here. It's T times VDS plus, or I should say VDS dt times dt plus SDV minus PDV. Okay, and the point is that these two sides have to be equal for all values of the two independent variables, T and V. So the coefficients of both of those, if we collect the coefficients of dV or the coefficients of dT, they have to be equal to one another. Let's collect the coefficients of dV. So on this side we have rho, and on this side we have that it is equal to T dS minus P. Okay, and let's rewrite that as, that's not right. What I meant is TS minus P. So, and let's just solve for S here. So the thing, the expression that I want is that the entropy density is the energy density plus the pressure divided by the temperature. Okay, now for a relativistic, for a gas of relativistic particles, we already saw last lecture that P and rho are related by that P is equal to 1/3 rho. So this really becomes, for a relativistic particle, this becomes 4/3 rho over T. But rho for a relativistic particle is this. So anyway, it's 4/3 times that prefactor pi squared over 30 times T to the fourth divided by T, so times T cubed. Okay, so S is proportional to T cubed, but on the other hand, this is a system where when we're thinking about these systems that are kind of be approximated as being in thermal equilibrium, but then they're reacting to the expansion of the universe, the physical systems in question, the physical systems in which it is appropriate to think that way are ones where the rate for the reactions, for the particle reactions that hold the system in thermal equilibrium, are much bigger than the Hubble expansion rate. So in other words, if this system is true, if this condition is true, then by the time that the universe has expanded by a significant amount, by the time that the particles, by the time that the universe has expanded by a factor of, you know, E, order one, so that the particles have had enough time to figure out that they actually are in an expanding universe, they've had enough time to tell that the universe is expanding, by that time, they've been created and destroyed many times. They've bumped into their neighbors a lot. They've had a lot of time to equilibrate. This is the situation that's analogous to when you're talking about this system, when you're talking about the first law of thermodynamics, and you think about a piston, and as you expand the piston, if you expand the piston sufficiently slowly, sufficiently adiabatically, then the entropy of the system doesn't increase. So this is the adiabatic approximation in cosmology, when the reactions necessary to hold the system at thermal equilibrium are fast relative to the rate at which the universe is expanding. If they're if they're very fast, then the system has time to equilibrate before it has time to notice that the universe is expanding at all. Okay, so in that situation, when the expansion is adiabatic, the total entropy, just like in the adiabatic piston, the total entropy isn't changing; it's a constant. And whenever you have a constant of motion in an FRW spacetime, again, let's think of our co-moving box that just cuts off a finite chunk of that spacetime. As it expands, the whatever conserved quantity is constant stays constant as a function of time within that box, but that conserved quantity is the density of that conserved quantity, little q, times the volume of the box, but the physical volume of the box is increasing as a cubed, and so in order for this thing, the total charge to remain constant, the total conserved quantity, capital Q, to remain constant, the density had better go down as a to the minus 3. And so that's what happens with entropy in a universe that is where this adiabatic condition is satisfied. The total entropy has to remain fixed, and so the entropy density has to decay as a to the minus 3. The entropy per physical volume has to decay as a to the minus 3 because the volume is increasing as a to the 3, and their product is supposed to remain constant. So we're supposed to now compare the entropy per physical volume calculated thermodynamically and the entropy per physical volume calculated from this argument about thinking about co-moving boxes, and see that for this to be true, T has to scale as a to the minus 1. Okay, I will stop after saying the following sentence, which might be a run-on, so that I can say that was ungrammatical, but did not really involve the end of a sentence. None of this is really ending. Okay. That was dumb. So what I mean to say is the following. As the universe expands, as A increases, T drops. So when a particle is relativistic, its physical number density and energy density drop. They dilute in this rather mild way as a power of T. But then at some point, T gets sufficiently low that it drops below the mass of that particle, if it's a massive particle. And then we transition into this regime, where suddenly, according to equilibrium thermodynamics, as T decreases, the number density, as A increases, and so T decreases, the number density of that particle species that has become non-relativistic is suddenly dropping much more dramatically as an exponential. So it can't keep that up. The reactions that are needed in order to keep this guy in thermal equilibrium We wanted those for the equilibrium or quasi-equilibrium picture to be true. We wanted gamma to be much bigger than h. But when these particles become so rare, it's too hard to find one of them to react with in order to keep it in thermal equilibrium. And at that point, when the relevant reaction rate for maintaining this equilibrium prediction becomes lower than the Hubble rate, we say that this particle has become so rare that it decouples from the thermal plasma. And this formula suddenly ceases to apply. And unless this particle can decay on its own, from that point forward, its number density may become suddenly conserved, and instead just decay like a conserved number density does, like we just said, like a to the minus 3. In other words, much more slowly than this would predict. And so that's exactly supposed to be the story with, that's the standard story about how the dark matter density, that's the most popular story for how the dark matter density today was created, that there was a particle in the early universe that was originally relativistic and in thermal equilibrium with everything else. Let's call it chi. Chi and its antiparticle love to run into one another, let's say, and create two photons, and that reaction was going back and forth, and everything was happy. And then suddenly, the mass of this, the temperature dropped below the mass of this particle, and then dun-dun, chi particles began mysteriously disappearing left and right. They began becoming exponentially rare. No one knew quite what was going on, but there was, you know, the chi was meeting a rapid end. But then when it got sufficiently rare, there were just so few chi particles that they couldn't find any other chi, so few chi and chi bars that they couldn't find one another to run into one another and annihilate two photons. So at some point, they just stopped annihilating, and their number, the total number of chi particles that was present at that moment, is equal to the number of chi particles that's present today. And you know, it turns out there's something called the Wimp miracle that we'll meet when we talk about dark matter. That for quite standard sort of expected values for the mass and cross section. Of these particles, that process gives rise to a predicted dark matter density today, which in fact matches the observed dark matter density. So that's why this is the most it's by no means clear yet that that's the correct picture of where dark matter came from, but that's why this is the most popular picture. Anyway, I think that's it.